I've recently returned, as most of you know, from 2 weeks at Ananda Village helping for the second phase of filming of a movie that's being made about the Ananda communities and about the idea of communities in general. I spoke at length about that last night, and that recording will be available on the internet if you're interested in that adventure. In brief terms, a very professional film crew has been working for the last year, but filming for a month this summer to try to capture in pictures and in words and eventually in music the real spirit of what Ananda is about, and to put out not exactly a documentary but more like an artistic feature film which tries to convey something of the spirit of what this community is about. I became involved in it sort of accidentally, almost. I was there to do a more mechanical task, and then suddenly it became necessary for someone to get involved a little bit more in forming what was really going to be the message based on things that Swami Kriyananda had already outlined, but it had to be defined. So I've spent a little more than a month, really about 5 weeks over this last summer, at Ananda Village, which is our original community. It's about 3 hours from here up in the mountains. It's a beautiful rural setting. Really looks exquisite when it's filmed beautifully. You know, places you've seen all your life, when suddenly somebody frames them and lights them and then just does them just so, you think, wow, is that my front door? And you open your front door, and indeed, there it is. But it's been also a very poignant experience for me. I've become intensely sentimental in the last few years. I never had babies, or we never raised children, but the Ananda life has been our family. I don't mean that in any pathetic sense. I mean that in the creative work that we've done, in the Ananda wedding ceremony that Swami Kriyananda wrote. One of the vows that the couple exchanges is, may the offspring of our union, whether children or creative deeds, be a reflection of the inspiration we feel within from the divine. So from early on in our marriage, which has now been over 3 decades, it was obvious to us that the offspring of our union would be creative deeds. I had one brief period of wanting to have a baby when a friend of mine had just given birth to her third child, and I'm holding the little baby. I was actually just looking at a picture. This is Lakshmi and Andrew Selby. I'm looking at myself holding Andrew Selby when he was like a day old, and I have this look. I'm looking like this. And I said to David, ooh, you know, like that. Very sweetly, he said, let's talk about it in a couple of weeks. You know, and as soon as I put him down, sanity returned to me. This is not the duty to which I am being called. But living through the experience of trying to convey Ananda on film, which is what I've been doing, I finally came to an understanding of what I've been laboring for and against in doing all of this. I'll give an example. One scene in the movie, it is a young couple, a man and a woman. A beautiful dance was choreographed to one of Ananda's songs, and it was filmed up on the ridgetop at the village into the setting sun. So it was just beautifully filmed. And the woman, Mirabai, her passion is the tango, but she's a gifted dancer in all ways. And her partner was Christopher Selby, and he's a professional ballet dancer. So they were gorgeous together. She's quite tall, and he's even taller, and they did this beautiful dance, and they filmed it over and over, as they do for these things. And afterwards, the director came up to me, and he asked me, you know, what did you think? Well, it was hard not to think it was gorgeous. It was so gorgeous. But I told him, I said, it's hard for me to tell, because I can't separate what I'm seeing now with a lifetime of memories that's associated with this. You know, when the parents got pregnant, when the baby was born, all the difficulties that they went through, you know, watching him throw up when he was small, you know, just all these things, and then seeing them all growed up, you know, behaving in this fabulous way. I'm sure parents go through this all the time. You can't really separate what you're looking at. So when I come now to this reading, seek ye first the kingdom of God, and all things will be added unto you. I come to this from now 4 decades of having made that decision quite a long time ago. And I cannot claim perfection, but I can claim a sincere effort all these years to live by some of these very simple principles. And it's hard for me to tell now sort of where it all parses apart and how to explain it. Because a lifetime is so much shorter than we actually think it is. It doesn't take long for you to realize how short it is. When you're a child, it seems like it's going to go on forever. I remember when I was 7 years old, and my mother sent me to sleepaway camp, and it was a Jewish camp, and they had these very, very long Friday evening services. And I have this picture of myself. We had to have these little blue and white shorts, the colors of the outfits, the colors of Israel is what we wore. And I remember these blue shorts that must have been big enough for a child of about 15. Because I can picture my little tiny legs like this sticking out of these enormous shorts, just sitting in this chair for the Sabbath service that went on for 17 days, I'm pretty sure. The reason I can remember what I look like, because I can remember my head just dropping and my just staring at my legs and wondering if I would ever get off that chair. And I remember falling asleep. I remember them carrying me away from there. You know, just all these different things with just this interminable period of time, which, you know, maybe it was a 45-minute service. Who knows, you know? At seven, time is very strange. And now I very casually say, oh, yes, I came to Ananda in 1971. I met Swami in 1969. We were working with the crew of the movie, and a lot of people who do that kind of work. A lot of the work, I have great respect now for movie crews. There's something called a grip, you know. I've seen all these names listed on movies. Now I actually know what these poor people do. Grips are people who grip things, often really big, heavy things, and they drag them from place to place. One of the grips says, every year on a movie set is a grip is 1 year off your sentence in hell. Is that what you put it? Because when you die and you go to hell, the devil says, oh, you worked as a grip on a movie set. Nothing I can do to you. So I watched these young people drag all these things around, and I became conscious of the fact that they thought I was old. Because I came to Ananda before many of them were even born, long before many of them were born. Sometimes at the time their parents were born. I mean, that's really a long time ago. But there was no sense of time passing. There was no sense of elderliness, you know, the kind of exhaustion you associate with time. When time seems long, it's because it's wearisome. And the years that I've spent at Ananda, the years since I met Swami Kriyananda, all the years before, which thank God were not many, you know, those were wearisome years, sitting on the sort of the edge of life, just looking at it and wondering how the heck this whole thing was going to work out. Looking at the neighbors, looking at my own parents, who were very nice people. They had a wonderful relationship with each other. They were honorable. There was nothing specific I could point to. By the grace of God, I didn't come up rough. I didn't come up troubled. But I came up, I think the only word you would call it is desperate. That quiet desperation that people don't like to acknowledge. Because what was I going to do? How is this really going to turn out? And just sitting on the edge of life, that's how I feel. I felt like I spent my whole life like a wallflower just looking at the party until Swami Kriyananda walked into my life, literally. And at that point, all of a sudden, it's just like, oh, I get it. I know where we're going, and I can see now how we're going to get there. And by the grace of God, you know, for me, it was a connection that was instantaneous, that was absolutely solid, and that in all these years has never been, never frayed. Seek ye first the kingdom of God. Oh, there is such a thing as the kingdom of God. And if that becomes the unifying thread, that's what I began to feel. I learned a little bit about self-realization prior to meeting Swami Kriyananda. I started reading a few years before he walked into my life. The reading just told me where I was trying to go. He told me how to get there, basically. But what I felt from the moment I was handed a book that described to me the principles of self-realization, which, as I understood them, were very simple. There is a goal to life. That goal is bliss. That goal is attainable. And you get there step by step. And the law of karma, which I didn't even really think of as the law of karma, but it was simply this. What I do today decides what my experience will be tomorrow. And what I'm experiencing today is determined by all the decisions I made yesterday. This wasn't hard for me to see. I mean, I didn't have to go into great realms that I didn't understand, that this world might be just a dream, that there's this power of God and this great force beyond and all the galaxies and all these things. None of that. My little brain just couldn't go there anyway. It was like, oh, I see. And I had just, not long before that, dropped out of college. And one of the interesting factors of being in college, which was so amazing to me, especially I was living in a women's dorm that was just before everything went co-ed and so on. So I was in this woman's dorm. I was actually at Stanford University. The director of the play was teasing me about how much mileage I get about being a college dropout because it was Stanford University. So I was at Stanford University at Robley Hall, which was this really, at that time we had served meals and linens on the table. I mean, all of that is just totally history now, but I was the last, one of the last years when that kind of reality was still there with all these women, many of whom were from very, very wealthy and socially prominent families. I'd never moved in those circles before. I really remember, this is completely off the subject, but this woman at the table, this was like my first dinner. Oh, she said, my parents told me the Depression was just terrible. Even if you had the money, you couldn't get the china patterns you wanted. You couldn't get the silver. This was the beginning of the end of my college career. What am I doing here? You know, where am I? How did I get here? But what I really began to realize, and this was my random opinion based on 18 years of life, is that college freshman girls were the most unhappy people I had ever met. Just unbelievably unhappy. Because all of them were desiring things that they probably weren't going to get, or they desired things in a kind of helpless, futile kind of way, without having any idea of how to focus their attention and their concentration in order to accomplish them. And even when those desires were clearly going to be thwarted, and in that period of time it was almost always about romance, you know, Mildred loves Harold, but Harold loves Maud, and Maud loves, you know, who knows, someone else over here. And so there was always this long trajectory of misery that was just going down the row. And we'd all sit up at night and talk to each other about how miserable we were, and I just was like, oh, Lord, please, this can't be it. You know, I've held on until I got to this prestigious university where somebody was supposed to teach me something useful, and I'm locked in this building with all these women who are worried about their silver patterns. You know, it was just a nightmare, living nightmare. But most of all, what I observed is that even though everyone said, I want to be happy, almost everyone wanted to be effortlessly happy. And they wanted to be happy without ever having to be inconvenienced. You know, like by, you know, always having the silver pattern you wanted if you had the money or whatever it might be. Or just having that medical student fall back in love with you, even though he seemed like kind of a creepy guy, and I'm not quite sure why you're so interested in him, but whatever it was just, I want it to be a certain way, with this kind of utterly bewildered, just shaking the bars, or banging on the doors, or banging on the wall, trying to demand that it be a door. And I was just very quietly, but completely hysterical inside. This can't be it, this can't be it, there's got to be an answer. And eventually, I left that place. Very soon after I left, the book was handed to me. Oh, it's in my hands. It's about my consciousness. It's not really about all that seems to be going on out there. I don't have to be dependent on whether this one loves me or that one loves me or these people recognize me or I have what I want or I have the money. It's all about my consciousness. And even more than that, I discovered there's this whole enormous parade of wise people who haven't just spun beautiful theories and, you know, sat there and they're professorial way and talked about various theories about what might be true and what's not true. These are joyful people, courageous people, many of whom have faced hardships beyond our wildest imaginings. and even in the midst of that, have held to what they know to be true, and it shows in their faces, it shows in their eyes, it shows in the way they move. That's what happened when Swami Kriyananda walked into the room. Theoretically, I had become persuaded that this was possible, and I had met many of these great souls through the pages of books. You know, a tremendous amount can be conveyed through the pages of books, both intellectual wisdom and a vibration of consciousness, a certain inspiration. Reading recently in the New Testament, I'm not a churchianity kind of Christian, and I read other books than the Bible, but not long ago I was reading the New Testament, and just something in the words of Jesus just became so alive on the page, and words that I'd read many, many times in my life were like brand new, because all of a sudden through them we are in contact with a living consciousness. And I really appreciated all those people you see in the buses and in the coffee shops who are just endlessly reading the Bible. I could say, oh, you could read this your whole life. You would never get bored, because each one of those words takes you into a reality that word merely represents. Yogananda himself, he said, when I am gone, read my whispers from eternity. Those are the poem prayers that we read every week on Sunday. Through it, I will speak to you, he said. And in the introduction to that book, he said, the challenge of reading this, I'm paraphrasing, he put it more beautifully, he said, is to get beyond the paper and the ink. He said, behind the paper and the ink is a living consciousness for which these words are just a doorway through. So by the grace of God, when I was only 19 years old, true wisdom was handed to me from souls who were truly great. Great not because they had money or they had fame, but great because they had liberated their own consciousness from all the binding conditions that hold most of us enthralled. As a young person growing up, I could never have articulated it, but I felt it. I didn't know what was wrong, because everything seemed fine, but I felt like I was living in a prison so small with so little air and no apparent escape. It was just called life, and it was called ordinary consciousness, and it was called not knowing what the heck is really going on here. You know, just go out and get for ourselves. Make yourself secure. Get a profession that will allow you to make enough money that you can have your own home and all of the things that everybody wants. That's what this planet is about. This is a planet in which we acquire for ourselves. Every planet has a characteristic. That's our planet. Our planet is go out and get yours, you know, and then pack it up somewhere and put your name on it and have it be yours. And that'll make you happy. But wandering through this planet are these great souls who say something completely else. Like Jesus, like Yogananda, like Buddha, like Krishna, and in my own life, in walks Swami Kriyananda. And I contemplate, just for the sheer joy of it, many times what that experience was like. But above all, for its relevancy to all of you, because now Kriyananda's 86 years old. He was 44, I think, when I met him. Very different stage of life. Time goes by. The body just kind of evaporates around you. He calls himself wobbly now. He's very wobbly. He used to be so strong, and now he's very wobbly. But what walked into the room in a strong, you know, man's body at that point was not that body. It was freedom of consciousness. And that freedom of consciousness is exactly what was written in our reading today. Seek ye first the kingdom of God, and all these things will be added unto you. What are these things? Oh, we think what might mean riches and prosperity and fame. Not necessarily. But everything that we want, that we think those things will give us. Why do we want those things at all? We don't want fame because we think it'll make us miserable. We don't want a beautiful home because we think it'll make us miserable. We don't want a relationship so we can suffer, suffer, suffer. We believe that if I have that, then I'll be happy. But it's the happiness we're seeking, isn't it? And even happiness, the saints tell us, is just a diminished octave of what we really want, which is the bliss of the divine. Sat, Chit, Ananda. Eternally existing, ever aware of itself, absolute bliss. It's hard even for us to imagine it, isn't it? We just think about, oh, after church is over, maybe I'll go and have pasta primavera somewhere. you know? Maybe I'll go and get breakfast. Maybe I'll go and have a coffee. You know, then I'll go home and I'll read the newspaper. And we just have all these little tiny movements of energy that we're working with. But every one of them is so that we can have that inner experience. And Jesus just cuts through it all. He just seeks the kingdom of God. And all the other things that you think you want, you'll find you already have them. And the spiritual path becomes, if not exactly easy, it's just not complex. It's every day we ask ourselves, how can I live more and more in the awareness, with a focus, making a priority of the only thing that really matters to me, which is molding and changing my own consciousness to be more and more in tune with what I really want. We begin with meditation. We have prayer. We have devotion. We open the Bible or whatever book it is that inspires us. We pay attention to whether we're bringing garbage into our lives or whether we're bringing things that uplift us. You know, the national scene, the international scene, the economic scene these days, it's really bizarre, I think is the only word for it, and getting worse. You know, I used to read the newspapers a lot more. I felt a certain responsibility to know. I finally realized that all I was hearing was bad news and all it was doing was making me nervous. And you really need to know about that much. You know, oh yeah, there's another election and one of them will win. You know, oh yes, greedy people are still making this planet just a nightmare, aren't they? And no matter how much we try to push against them, they just still keep doing it. But the good news is, you see, God is in charge. Seek ye first the kingdom of God. Swami Kriyananda recently has commented several times on a fact that is an amazing fact. Apparently, when the atom bomb was dropped on those Japanese cities, when we dropped the atom bomb, we being the Americans, on those Japanese cities, right in the middle of the devastation zone, there were two small religious communities that were untouched. One was a group of Franciscan nuns, I believe, and the other was Jesuit priests. How can you even think of such a thing? You know, now, of course, we're not doing this just to be protected, but nobody minds being protected. But amazing, isn't it? Amazing to think that even the laws of nature will be changed by higher laws of spirit. Swami Kriyananda tells a story of a miracle that Yogananda himself did for one of his advanced disciples, Oliver Black. Oliver Black lived in Detroit. He was visiting Yogananda in Encinitas, Southern California, where Master had an ashram. Master would often go out for rides in the car. I remember my parents used to go out for rides. That's not something we do much anymore. I don't know, we go out and spend money. But you used to get in the back of the car and your parents would take you for a ride. You know, I remember it vividly. We'd all look out the window. We'd go someplace pretty for a ride. Master used to go out for a ride in his car. So it was absolutely raining cats and dogs, just sheets of water. And word came to Oliver Black that Yogananda wanted to take him out for a ride in the car. And Oliver thought, well, we won't even be able to see out the window, but okay if he wants to go. And his room was right next to the front entryway. He got his coat, he went through the door, through the hallway to the front door. By the time he got to the front door, it was absolutely no rain at all. The sky was perfectly blue, and the ground was dry. And Yogananda just looked at Oliver and said, for you, Oliver. Just like that. Swamiji has mentioned recently also that Master was drawing Oliver into a closer relationship with him at that time, wanting him to understand more deeply that all blessings come from attunement to the Guru. And so it was for that reason also that he did it. You are so worried. We are so worried about everything, aren't we? Just about everything. You can just kind of globally say it. We just worry about everything. The global situation is really not nice. Swamiji makes it even worse by promising us that it's going to get worse. Oh, that's helpful, sir. I love hearing that. You know, people say, why does he talk like that? Well, Yogananda talked like that. Yogananda warned people that the situation in this world was not going to get better. It's going to get much worse before it gets better. That we're in a transition from a lower age of matter consciousness, of form, of holding on to materialism, of holding on to wealth and power and egoic things. We're moving into an age of greater enlightenment, but changes like this are often rough. And we chose, for reasons that seemed like a good idea at the time, to incarnate into this situation, right? So how do we deal with it? Seek ye first the kingdom of God. Because in the end, no matter what you're gripping, it will be taken away from you. Recently at Ananda Village, there were 3 or 4 people who died in the last 6 months. One man was very elderly, but the other 3 were not so old. My friend Leela, who has been Swami Kriyananda's cook for the last 20 years, on her birthday, she cooked the last meal she has ever cooked for him, and a month and a day later, she had died from cancer, which was advanced in her body. I was at Durga's house, my friend Durga, who'd been caretaking her, and the phone rang at 2 in the morning. Leela had slipped away in the night. She just died very quietly, so I went over there. It's extremely dynamic to see someone's body after the soul is gone. There's a practice in India of aspiring yogis go sit in cremation grounds and meditate in the night in cremation grounds. To some people, it seems really morbid. I think it's thrilling. I love it. I love the idea. We were in Kasipur, this place in India, and I was able to sit where Ramakrishna used to meditate on the cremation grounds. I guess I am a little sort of, I have that kind of Shivite yogi. I just love sitting there in the cremation grounds meditating. So I went over to Leela's house, and there she was, except she wasn't. You know, there was her beautiful little body. And we know she was all cleaned up by then. We put her into one of her blue outfits, and she was just lying on her bed under her beautiful pink coverlet, except she wasn't. She was just gone. She's just on her way to the next round. And all the beautiful things that she did in this world, the beauty of them remains, but the things are just gone. Just gone, just gone like that. All we ever have is our consciousness. You know, do we want to pass out of this body clutching on to all this stuff hopelessly? All that causes us is to rush right back and get to hold it again, or even worse, to kind of get trapped between the worlds because we can't let go of this and we won't embrace that. But just seeing her there and knowing that she was gone. Oh, Leela, I said, just to her, to myself and her empty body, you lived about as well as a person can live. You know, for many, many years, the only reality to you is the kingdom of God. All we have to do is step by step, because there's no real time. There's no great, big, giant lifetime that we have to live. It's not like we make a lifetime decision now. We make a one-minute decision now. Just a one-minute decision. That's why 40 years is like nothing. It's just like nothing, because there never was 40 years. There was just now. And do I have the courage? Now. Do I have the understanding? Now. Do I have the energy and commitment and creativity? Now. Seek ye first the kingdom of God, and all these things shall be added unto you. Master after master after master after master has told us that it's true. And I'm a lot more willing to take their word for it than mine. Mine hasn't really proven to be all that positive. But oh my, the example. Just picking up the New Testament and feeling that living presence of Jesus just coming out of those pages, looking at Yogananda's picture, being in the presence of Swami Kriyananda, singing music, you know, watching words and people and bliss and bliss and bliss. That's all we want anyway. Let's just cut out all the intermediaries and go right to the source. God bless you.